You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of May, 2012, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Nancy Durham. We have a lively hour for you. We'll talk football as the English Premier League wraps up its season and ask why the game remains one of Britain's biggest soft power exports. Spanish protesters are in the streets en masse this evening, and our own Liam Aldus is on the scene. Sophie Grove will be here with her picks of the week's global affairs stories, and we'll talk cities with Monocle magazine editor Andrew Tuck, who's in that great city next door, Paris. And we'll investigate what's gone wrong in Pakistan for that glorious fruit, the mango. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Now here's Nick Kelly with the news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Syrian rebels killed 23 government soldiers today as efforts to find a viable political alternative to Bashar al-Assad faltered when an opposition group said it would boycott Arab-backed talks to unite its splintered ranks. The latest bloodshed centred in the town of Rastan, where opposition sources said shelling by President Assad's forces killed nine other people, further unravelling a month-old UN ceasefire pact that's being overseen by international monitors. Two men were killed and at least 20 were wounded in clashes between Alawite supporters of President Assad and Sunni Muslims in the Lebanese city of Tripoli. Fierce clashes overnight shook the northern port city and sporadic fighting continued today. Greek political leaders stuck to entrenched positions before another round of coalition talks today, dashing hopes of a last-minute compromise to avoid a new election that risks pushing the country closer to financial default. European shares slid and Spanish and Italian bond yields rose. As investors fretted the political deadlock, meant Greece was on track to become the first country to abandon the euro. A political analyst from the Hellenic Foundation for European and Foreign Policy said a return to the drachma would create social instability.
The main reason why the Troika itself is not prepared right now to renegotiate the agreement is the fact that Greek political leaders are not reliable.
Hundreds of Afghans have attended the funeral ceremony of a top peace negotiator who was shot dead by gunmen in the capital Kabul yesterday. Malvi Arsala Rahmani, a 68-year-old former Taliban minister, was one of the most senior members of Afghanistan's High Peace Council, which was set up by President Hamid Karzai 2 years ago to open negotiations with insurgents. Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails have agreed to an Egyptian-brokered deal aimed at ending a mass hunger strike that challenged Israel's policy of detention without trial and raised fears of a bloody Palestinian backlash if any protesters died. Most of some 1,600 prisoners, a third of the 4,800 Palestinians in Israeli jails, began refusing food on April the 17th, although a few had been fasting much longer, up to 77 days. NATO airstrikes killed 72 civilians in Libya last year, Human Rights Watch said today, accusing the Western alliance of failing to acknowledge the scope of collateral damage it caused during the campaign that helped oust Muammar Gaddafi. In a report based on investigations and at bombing sites during and after the conflict, the New York-based HRW said NATO strikes killed 20 women and 24 children. Fred Abrams is special advisor at Human Rights Watch.
They refused to acknowledge that civilians died, they refused to give information about how they died, and they refused to investigate. And it's this lack of transparency that's deeply troubling. And I think it will lead to unnecessary civilian deaths in the future.
The Tibetan Buddhist spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, held a news conference in London today before his formal acceptance of this year's Templeton Prize. The Templeton Prize, valued at £1.1 million, is the world's largest annual monetary award given to an individual. The Dalai Lama is being honoured for his long-standing engagement with multiple dimensions of science and with people far beyond his own religious traditions. He said that most of the money would be going to the Save the Children charity. The Dalai Lama spoke about his humility over the award, the need for people to work hard, and of the continuing positive links between scientific research and religion.
It always confirmed me. Ultimate source of calm mind, happiness, joyfulness is within ourselves.
And a day before France's president-elect, François Hollande, gets ready to take on his role as leader of the country, the French today laid out their expectations and hopes for him on a giant wall in central Paris. With Paris's famous Bastille column as the backdrop, the wall with a poster of Hollande had a huge number of messages from members of the public. Some were encouraging, others congratulatory, and some had specific demands. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick. Nice to see you and hear you.
And you too.
You've been well?
I thought you were going to ask me what the specific demands were, but I can't tell you, I'm afraid.
Perhaps the next time you pop in.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Lovely to see you. You're looking really well.
You too.
And it is now 5 minutes past 1800 hours in London anyway, and you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London から Monocle 24 です。
Londonista käsin, tämä on Monocle 24.
London boy, as a Monocle 24.
Londonan, burası Monocle 24.
Londonist, sinä Monocle 24.
London から London より Monocle 24.
Well, as far as sporting drama goes, it does not get much better than yesterday's final fixture of the English Premier League. In the last 2 minutes of the season, Manchester City managed to score 2 goals, snatching the league title from their rivals, Manchester United. The home grounds of the two teams may be just a few miles apart, but the victory is far from just a local story. Newspapers around the world are today carrying the story. Everyone's talking about it, and it's the latest example of how football is one of England's most important exports and a highly effective agent of soft power. The big audiences and even bigger money associated with the English Premier League are the star strikers for brand Britain. Well, to discuss its importance, we're joined on the telephone by Dr. Rogan Taylor. He's director of the Football Industry Group. Welcome, Dr. Taylor.
Hi.
Well, what a finish yesterday. Unheard of. Were you watching?
I certainly was, yes. It was absolutely fantastic. I mean, God must be writing this script. Nobody else could, that's for sure.
Wonderful. So what's the next line in the script? Why don't you tell me what this means?
Well, I mean, that's something which I think those people who don't sort of understand or watch football, and let's face it, there must be probably a couple of billion people out there who don't don't appreciate how unscripted a drama it is. It's genuinely unscripted. And the game is not, I mean, amongst many American sports, for example, the game is structured to provide almost a sort of guaranteed climax.
Like, you think of American football and it's that hideous thing, you've got to wait for the play, then everybody walks along a little bit and does it again.
Yeah, and you know, if you look at the American version of netball, which I believe they call basketball. That's it. You know, you get sort of, I mean, it's basically a series of goals and squeaks, isn't it? It just goes squeak, 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 goal. I mean, these guys are 7'2". And they can use their hands. And getting a ball in a basket, well, you know, I mean, it isn't too difficult for these magnificent physical specimens who play that game.
Okay, well, let's come back to our magnificent physical specimens here. Then I'd like to think about them and picture them. Why are Englanders, Englander footballs so loved around the world? Footballers.
Well, I mean, it's odd because the English Premier League is of course, 60% foreign nationals playing. I think there's only 35% or so of players in the teams who are, you know, British or even English citizens. And so it's not something which is about who plays it. It's about the audience and what they demand. And in England, traditionally, and this goes back for a long time, we go for a kind of slap-bang-wallop football, which in Italy and Spain especially and various other places doesn't work so well. But it means it's highly dramatic.
Are games, our players, and I say our, they're international, more surprising and unexpected? What happens in them?
No, I mean, I think that it's, you know, I mean, I think in the end, the show that you get is controlled by the audience that watches it. I think this is true entirely through showbiz and entertainment. And the football you get in England, despite its continentalization over the last 20 years in particular, remains distinctly British. You know, a lot of English fans, if they watch Barcelona, can't see it. They're going, oh, God, it's boring. Look, they've got the ball all the time, and they're so skillful and so beautifully sort of positioned tactically and so on. It's just, come on, it's absolutely boring. You know, we want to lose the ball all the time, and so that somebody else regains it and something happens that nobody expects. There's a sense in which English football is so bad it's good. And of course, the real proof of what English football is about is that in 100 years and more, 120 years now, I guess, of international competition, England has appeared in one final only, a home match in 1966 with a dodgy Azerbaijani linesman, and they got lucky and won it.
And still the audience sticks with them.
Exactly, because it's not about the best football. It's about the best drama. And that's what we provide.
So this is the, and are you talking about the English people now? It's a very, very international country I live in here, and England and Great Britain.
Oh, it is. But, you know, I mean, it's, and of course, as we've said, these teams are made up of, you know, a lot of different nationalities. There are probably only, what, two or three Englishmen in that, that Manchester City team. And the same probably applies to Manchester United, maybe three or four, I'm not sure. But what happens is that performers respond to what is encouraged by the audience. The audience likes a certain kind of football. They like lots of effort. They like pace. They don't really go for fancy Dan control and carefully organized triangles. They go for the, you know, for the crash bang wallop. And the crash bang wallop is what you get. And the thing about crash bang wallop is you don't know what's going to happen next. And that's what people love.
But isn't it fascinating that this this still appeals to an audience here, which is changing. It's still England, but the audience is greatly changing.
Not just the audience here, I might say. I mean, I haven't seen the numbers, but there's probably a billion people watching yesterday afternoon on the Premier League, all over the world. And they love it a bit.
And those people all over the world, though, have I got it wrong? Do they really kind of love England, number one?
Well, no, I think it's the best entertainment. They may well say, actually, okay, I mean, as everybody knows, Spanish football is the best in the world right now. Barcelona are the greatest football club in the world, and Spain are the European champions and the world champions. But say, do you want to watch Spanish football instead of watching the Premier League? Well, the money tells you the answer is no, because the values associated with the TV rights for the Premier League outstrip all of the others by a considerable margin.
Wow.
The money speaks, doesn't it?
It sure does. But look, I'm still stuck on this audience then, and you're painting a wonderful picture. The people do want the English teams to start winning internationally, don't they?
I'm sure there's, well, certainly the English do.
Yeah, we do.
I don't know about anybody else.
But there's something about this crash-bang-wallop that's not delivering the cups they want to win.
The thing is, crash-bang-wallop doesn't work at the highest level of the game. What works at the highest level of the game, as we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years, is tiki-taka. This beautiful little short passing triangles, wonderfully mobile, and with a diamond gem like Messi at its centre, or in the case of the Spanish national team, of course, David Silva plays this sort of poor man's Messi. That's perfect, almost perfect football. It's a bit like beauty. Perfect beauty.
And it's called ticker-tacker.
Yes, they call it ticker-tacker in Spain. It's just, you know, tick-tack, tick-tack, the ball going, passing quickly, one-to-one. Oh, somebody always in space, controls so perfect that even in the tightest of spaces, players can receive the ball and give it again, and it moves forward and it moves wide and it comes back to the centre. They never just lump the ball into the middle of the penalty area in the hope that someone might get on the end of it. That's not the way it's played, but here, well, sometimes that is the way it's played.
It sounds like music, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I think the beauty analogy is quite a useful one. Sometimes the most beautiful people in the world, the most beautiful women in the world, are not the most attractive, and the most attractive can often include imperfections, which convert it to more attractive. Whereas perfection has a potential for boredom.
Wow, you're a treasure. I'm so glad our crew found you. It's really fun to listen to you. We want more of you on the show.
Well, I've only just thought of that, but I think there's a kind of truth in there. I think that's the truth about the attraction of English football, that it's a bit of a mess, but bloody hell, don't they try hard, and isn't it pacey, and isn't it fantastic, and how you can't predict what's going to happen next is wonderful.
How exciting. Great to hear you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All the best. Dr.
Bye
Rogan
now.
Taylor, director of the Football Industry Group.
Pack your bags and join us on the latest episode of Section D as we head north to tackle Stockholm's ailing architecture landscape. We hit Tel Aviv to hear how it's saving its Bauhaus legacy. And we talk to the photographers of tomorrow at the IER Festival of Fashion and Photography.
I did a poster call on the streets in Bed-Stuy, a neighborhood of Brooklyn in New York, to find someone who never took a photo. And I found a guy called Harrison, and he selected the photos for my photo ceiling installation.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24. Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London, and New York.
I feel I should have a football anthem for you right now. I'm working on that. But in the meantime, I do have a song. This is Young Blood by The Naked and Famous. Young Blood by The Naked and Famous. This is a day three, in fact, of a 4-day mass demonstrations across Spain, a countrywide campaign to protest against austerity cuts, a change in electoral laws, and lack of jobs, to name just a few of the complaints on the minds of the demonstrators. Well, Monocle's man in Madrid, Liam Aldus, is on the story, and he's on the line now from Madrid. Hello, Liam.
Hi, Nancy. How are you?
I'm very well. How about you in Spain? What is the atmosphere there? Take us there.
Well, I think the demonstrations generally demonstrate, if you will, the frustration with the political system here. I mean, the demonstrations this week are actually the anniversary of the 15M movement, which is the 15M movement, which stands for the 15th of May, when last year hundreds of thousands of people mobilized against austerity and the lack of government action in Spain and just the lack of a voice, really. So this year they're celebrating the anniversary, and a lot of people don't realize, but the protests last year were actually the precursor for the Occupy Wall Street movement and similar protests from around the world. So there have been similar protests around the world as well, but the epicenter obviously is Spain.
So it's an anniversary of a protest. Some people might say, you know, so what?
Well, exactly, and I'm thinking the same thing, but I guess what they are kind of demonstrating is that the Spanish electoral laws and the political system just doesn't provide an effective third voice for the people. The two main political parties have basic general control over the political system, and the electoral laws prevent small parties from gaining traction. So I think this is just the materialization of this effect in the electorate.
Well, and people must, but the numbers in the streets, there's a lot of people out there, but it's not as big as last year. Is that right?
No, it's not. A lot of people have become disillusioned with the movement. I mean, obviously, like, it is generally a leftist movement, but there are a lot of elements and a lot of different interests represented in the masses. But because nothing was really achieved last year it was the socialists were governing, but now the conservatives are governing. And, I mean, after these thousands of people went out onto the streets, the majority of the population voted for the opposition conservatives, which have gone ahead and broken a lot of their electoral promises, have brought in even tougher measures, and the situation has gotten worse. So people just feel generally disillusioned with the system. And, I mean, the people who are extremely disillusioned are taking to the streets. But in the end, it becomes a bit of a soapbox for grievances. And I don't know what's going to be achieved, especially because their main demands are upon the politicians themselves, who have to reform the political system. And they're not going to do that because they have to relinquish a bit of power. So it's a bit of a stalemate.
Living there, seeing this, feeling the disappointment and the malaise, what do people... What do you hear again and again? What are the things people tell you, and what do they complain about?
Well, generally, the politicians don't listen to them. And, I mean, the constitution was designed after the fall of Franco, or the death of Franco, to basically encourage stability. So there hasn't been many referendums in Spain. Politicians generally don't bring in referendums. So the political system does really entrench the existence and the force of the two major parties. So I think if there was a bigger, stronger Greens party, for example, or some kind of third voice, people would be able to channel this anger into the party, into the electoral system, but they can't. So I'm worried personally that things are going to get a lot more, people are going to get more frustrated, and they're going to resort to more extreme measures. And we did see, I mean, there was a small protest against the on the Madrid Metro, where a coordinated protest where they pulled the brakes on various trains during peak hour. And this is just one small example of more extreme measures that they may take. So
when was that, Liam?
This was 2 or 3 weeks ago, actually, recently.
Does the government show any sign, it doesn't sound like it, but I'll ask anyway, of listening, of taking any note of what's going on?
Well, interestingly, the socialists last year at the end of last year, during the election campaign, were giving some kind of subconscious nods to the movement and making conciliatory gestures in a kind of subtle way, maybe to gain more votes, but it didn't work. They lost in a landslide. And now the ruling conservatives aren't listening. They put 1,000 riot police on the streets in Madrid over the weekend, and they're still out there. And I mean, I was part of I was viewing the demonstrations on Saturday, and it was quite interesting to see the thousands of people marching down Gran Vía and riot police charging towards them, and everyone scattered into the back streets. But they were trying to prevent them from going to Seoul, and that didn't work. People went to Seoul and stayed there until the early hours of the morning. But by the time, by about 5 a.m. in the morning, there was only 200 or 300 people left, and the police removed them by force. So they have taken a tougher line. I mean, the Madrid regional governor actually referred to the protesters as a bunch of quarrelsome, rowdy drunks. So that's quite harsh language, and she's got no time for them, obviously. So, I mean, the conservatives aren't really listening, and this is actually causing more frustration. But there is a bit of antipathy as well, so...
And tomorrow's day 4 of 4, so is there any expectation that things will develop in some way, or is it just going to...
Tomorrow is the 15th, so it's the actual anniversary, so they're expected to be greater numbers, but what will they achieve? It's quite frustrating for everyone involved as to what they'll achieve. They have actually splintered into small community groups, and they are trying to encourage small suburbs and local communities to try and take action, but this isn't really visible in the media, for example. And the media is quite critical of the movement as well, because they're quite splintered and they don't have an effective communication campaign, so it's quite easy to criticize them, but what they're doing on the ground isn't visible, so it's hard to actually gauge what success they're having.
Do people feel tense? Is there a tension?
There is a tension. There's a bit of a tension. It's hard to tell. I mean, in Madrid, it's a city of leisure. So people, even the protests themselves, it's anger, but it's also there's just kind of a fun spirit in the protests. They're quite angry, but they're still drinking and they're still entertainment and they're still just showing that they care. It's like a visual statement, I guess. So there isn't so much tension in the streets of Madrid. And Madrid is probably the best city in Spain. There's the unemployment level is the lowest here and. But I mean, people are quite politically active, so I wouldn't say there's a tension, but there's a bit of there's frustration, at least.
And obviously, there's not going to be any resolution. Listening to you, not
this
week.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, it's a stalemate. It's not going to get any better. And there are protests every week. This is a significant protest because it's an anniversary protest. But there's protests every weekend. There's one or two or three different interest groups protesting against austerity and. Lack of jobs and the new policies the government are announcing day after day that are quite harsh. So I don't think it will get any better, but it has to be changed for it to get better. They have to change the political system at least. Especially the Senate, for example, is a rubber stamp Senate. There's not many smaller parties in the Senate, and the government has a blank check, if you will, because they control both houses of parliament. So this is a very, very significant problem.
Liam, it's good to check in with you. Thanks so much.
London, as a Monaco 24.
Aus London, das ist Monaco 24.
De Londres, essa é Monaco 24.
De Londres, este es Monaco 24.
London, cala. Monaco 24 です.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
Londonist, sino Monaco 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monaco 24.
Λοντόστα, τέμα on Monaco 24.
Λόντζαδαν, βουρσε Monaco 24.
Λόντον καρα, Monaco 24.
Coming up in the next half hour on Midori House, Sophie Grove's Global Affairs selection and Pakistan's mango crops. Why is this delectable fruit in decline? But first, here's Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Thanks, Nancy. Syrian rebels killed 23 government soldiers today as efforts to find a viable political alternative to Bashar al-Assad faltered when an opposition group said it would boycott Arab-backed talks to unite its splintered ranks. Greek political leaders stuck to entrenched positions before another round of coalition talks today, dashing hopes of a last-minute compromise to avoid a new election that risks pushing the country closer to financial default. US stocks fell today, tracking global equity markets lower, as the political impasse in Greece heightened concerns about Europe's debt crisis and fears mounted about an economic slowdown in China. Hundreds of Afghans have attended the funeral ceremony of a top peace negotiator who was shot dead by gunmen in the capital Kabul yesterday. The British Foreign Secretary William Hague said today the European Union will impose tougher sanctions on Iran if it fails to take concrete steps to allay international concerns over its nuclear programme. Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails have agreed to an Egyptian brokered deal aimed at ending a mass hunger strike that challenged Israel's policy of detention without trial and raised fears of a bloody Palestinian backlash if any protesters died. West Africa's regional bloc ECOWAS will start deploying troops to Guinea-Bissau by Friday to oversee a reform of the local army and a transition back to civilian rule after a military coup. At least 15 passengers and crew were killed today when a small private plane crashed trying to land at a mountain airstrip in the Mount Annapurna region of Nepal. And a day before France's president-elect François Hollande gets ready to take on his role as leader of the country, the French today laid out their expectations and hopes for him on a giant wall in central Paris. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Nick. And now, as promised, Sophie Grove is with us, our senior editor.
Hello.
Hi. Nice to see you.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you've got world affairs at your fingertips there.
I have. I don't know where to start, really. I've got lots of sort of slightly interconnected stories.
Okay. Let's try to weave them together.
I wanted to begin by talking about Mongolia. Because, you know, there's so much focus on Ukraine, and I'm going to come on to that later because there's been a meeting between lots of EU foreign ministers today in Brussels about Ukraine. But there's a sort of parallel story going on in Mongolia that mirrors Timoshenko's plight in Ukraine. And in Ulaanbaatar, which is the capital of Mongolia, there's the former prime minister has been arrested in the middle of the night. The anti-corruption police came for him, Nambaran Enikbia, and put a bag over his head and dragged him out of his house, and now he's in jail. No charges yet, but it's very similar to the situation in Ukraine, where, you know, he was very popular until 2009. He was president, and then he he was elected out. There was some rioting during the election time when his opposition leader, who's the guy who's banged him up, President Sakya Elbegov. I think that's how you say it.
Well done, you. I could just ask, was he fairly elected out? Do we think it was a fair election? Do we know?
The thing about this is, it's the same as Ukraine. It's a very flawed situation, and there's some commentators that say that even Tymoshenko could be doing the same thing back to her opponents if, you know, the shoe was on the other foot. I mean, that's complete. That's a hypothetical.
Gossip.
Yeah. I mean, but yeah. The fact is that there it isn't a perfect democracy, and as much as, you know, the US has held Mongolia up as a democracy, and they are doing quite well if you compare them to somewhere like Russia, it looks like he was flawed, but at the same time he's now in prison, he's on hunger strike, he's quite elderly, and his son has been quoted in the New York Times today saying it's a purge, and it does look a bit like it's a purge. He's being released, interestingly, on the eve of the election, the parliamentary election on June the 28th. So if he's in any good shape, he can still run in the election.
Although he will have been deprived of any opportunity to campaign before it.
Hmm. Exactly. And then there's a really interesting piece in the New York Times today about Mongolia, actually, and the capital. You know, it says that thousands of herders who've left the countrysides in recent years are living in the capital in slums. It's hugely rich in terms of its natural resources. And then, you know, that type of mineral-rich, gas-rich state is making this very the gap between rich and poor, and these herders and slums and these Louis Vuitton shops on the highway, the gap is widening. So it's in many ways it's similar to Ukraine. And I was going to move on to talk about Ukraine.
Okay, I was just going to ask you. What have they decided today in Brussels? Have they?
Well, they've decided nothing. You'll be glad to hear.
I'm so surprised.
I know they've postponed ratifying a cooperation agreement with Ukraine. So in a sense, there is a little bit of consensus in the sense that they haven't ratified the thing yet, but they haven't agreed to snub Ukraine, and they haven't agreed in any unanimous sense or any sense whether they're going to go and endorse the Ukrainian host, the Ukrainian football tournament that's coming up, the European football tournament next month. So it's a bit of a poor show from the EU.
And Yulia Tymoshenko, right? Where is she now?
She's been moved to hospital. So she was just moved yesterday under the care of a German doctor. She's got severe back problems, and that was really the main thing. But she's been hunger striking for quite a bit since mid-April. So she is in quite a bad way, they say, although people haven't really been able to see very much of her. She was jailed last October. She's 51. And it's interesting because the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, said last week that Ukraine was a dictatorship, likening it to Belarus. And they haven't responded well to that, as you can imagine. But then there's been this sort of wish-wash, you know, slightly mixed messages coming from the Dutch and also our own foreign secretary, saying sort of, well, we're not quite sure whether we're going to go, and maybe we will, and we probably, you know, it's kind of, it hasn't really worked. So it's a shame, and as like a lot of things involving the EU this week, people aren't too pleased at the reaction. But they've still got some time left, and they've postponed the decision for a couple of weeks, so we'll see whether or not they do manage to come up with a proper boycott or a proper position on the treatment of Yulia Tymoshenko.
And staying with the EU, if you like, we were just on the line with Liam in Spain, hearing about the unhappiness, the unrest there. Greece must be on your mind.
It is. And it's interesting because, as we saw yesterday, the Greeks were desperately trying to to cobble something together and come up with an agreement and make an emergency cabinet, which they didn't manage to do yet.
There's still a chance that when a little left-wing party can come in to make a coalition and...
There is, but there's a lot of talk about the 37-year-old radical Alexis Tsipras, who is the head of the far left. And it's quite interesting. He's really rallied, even though his policies are unbelievably hopeful in the situation that we see Greece actually is fiscally. He's really rallying the popular vote. And so we're seeing this. There's a brilliant profile of him again in the New York Times today. And it's looking at him and going, you can go on his Facebook and people just love him. It says, I want to marry you in a sec. And they call him this, you know, they're describing him as this wonderful, chiselled, thick black hair, smouldering eyes, an attractive girlfriend.
Wow.
He's seduced the public and promised to give them what European leaders say is impossible. And that's to keep Greece in the euro currency whilst tearing up the bailout that staved off their bankruptcy.
And he's the head of the far left party, but not the main left party.
Yes, he's a former civil engineer. And
you got a picture of him there for me.
I don't. We'll have to Google it, frankly. We're going to have to get on the Facebook.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, there's one person that comes on saying, you're so sexy, Alexi. And then there's a new, apparently there's a new slogan on the internet that says, come on, Alexi, for a Greece that's sexy.
All right, well, yeah.
And it's really interesting. They've been talking to a lot of even elderly people in Greece, and he apparently just is really popular. And so it's a really difficult situation in the sense that, you know, these inept, crooked old men, you know, who've squandered the fortunes of Greece, it hasn't worked, and the cabinet isn't coming together. And he's a sort of revolutionary hero in all of this.
Interesting, isn't
especially
it?
Especially as he's, you know, putting his foot down and refusing to really do something. And it could be the unravelling of the Greek economy if he really sticks to it, especially if they don't manage to cobble together a government and they call an election later on in June, which is likely, when they say they think Alexi, sexy Alexi, will really get the votes in.
So sexy Alexi is the man to watch. And his full name is?
Oh, sorry, Alexis Tsipras.
You're doing well with the names.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well,
Tsipras.
It might not be perfect, but it's Tsipras.
Oh, like tzatziki.
So that's tzatziki. Yeah. So that's the sexy part.
Tzatziki. No, that's tzatziki. Okay, great. I think that's it. I think our time's up.
Oh well, thank you for having me.
Are you okay with that?
I'm totally fine with that.
Well,
I keep going, but I think that's all I have to say about Greece.
Well, thank you very much. I think I say karisto or parakalo. Hello, goodbye. You're welcome, thank you, or something like that.
I don't actually speak any Greek apart from sort of the retsina tzatziki.
Well, we'll work on the tzatziki and things. Sophie Grove, senior editor. Thank you very much. Thank you.
A bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries. Dance.
You're cordially invited to tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
In the latest edition, we celebrate the art of wandering with writer and psychogeographer Ian Sinclair. Enjoy live music from Astrid Williamson, kick-ups and dusty grooves in Chicago, and a lead through a chaotic maze in Paris by Jean Deloisy.
You have all the transformation of the self-portrait of Picasso slowly becoming a minotaur.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wing Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 is over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Well, we are going to talk about mangoes in Pakistan in a moment, but right now I have a piece of music for you. This is Default by Django Django. That was Default by Django Django.
Stan escuchando Monocle 24.
The proper Jalabert, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Extreme and unpredictable weather conditions in Pakistan are having a devastating effect on the nation's precious mango crop. Pakistanis rely on it for their economy and for their diet. Anatole Levin is the author of Pakistan, a Hard Country, and he's lecturer in the War Studies Department at King's College London. And Anatole is on the line now from his home in London. Good evening.
Hello.
Well, let's just start by asking, how serious is this crop failure or demise, however we should call it?
Well, it looks as if the crop will be down by about 30%. It's not clear yet, as the result chiefly of frosts. Frosts are not something that one normally associates with Pakistan, but in fact it can get pretty cold in the winter. They'll still be able to export, but domestic prices will rise pretty sharply. And that'll be bad for the existing government and for internal stability, because prices of goods in general have been rising steeply in recent years, and that's made a lot of people, of course, very unhappy.
Is there any sign of unrest yet in relation to this particular problem with the mango?
Well, you wouldn't see people, you know, rioting particularly because of the mangoes, but you know, if everything else is going up, if the price of, you know, basic staples like rice and onions are going up, if there are constant electricity cuts, then, well, to put it mildly, a big rise in the price of mangoes doesn't exactly help. And also, of course, it will mean, you know, diminished profits for the mango growers in the countryside. And since the terrible floods a couple of years ago, something rather odd and unexpected has happened, which is that, in fact, Pakistani agriculture has undergone something of a limited boom. It's partly because, of course, the boom in China goes on driving up food prices, but also because, weirdly enough, floods actually replenished areas that had been suffering from drought. Oh. But this, of course, now the, you know, agriculture in South Asia is still a very, in many ways, traditional and unpredictable business. And so, of course, these frosts will knock agriculture back again.
And as you say, down maybe 30%.
Yes.
Can we just diverge for a little bit? Maybe this is the anthropological end, but culturally, this fruit is incredibly important in Pakistan and connected to festivals. People plan their weddings around mango harvest time, I understand.
Yes, especially in Sindh, which is the greatest area of mango growing. Mangoes are, well, almost the kind of Sindhi national fruit. And there are endless varieties of mangoes, far more than we usually see in the West. And they can be eaten, of course, in so many different ways, you know, whether as fruit, but also as pickles, as chutneys, you know, with salt and lemon. And during the mango season, you can get mangoes with almost anything in that part of the world. So, yes, they're culturally very important. Well, one of the sad things for Pakistan is that because of the inefficiency of much of their agriculture, but also because of various technical difficulties, and perhaps because of Western tastes as well, they haven't been able yet to turn this into a really major export industry. They've been making some tens of millions of dollars every year, but they should really be making hundreds of millions. One of the things here is that they, of course, up to now haven't had access to the Indian market. And one of the things that a lot of mango growers dream of, along with industrialists, is that maybe this most favored nation treaty that they now have in place with India will open up India's markets. You know, India's huge cities with their also mango-eating populations, and that this may produce a mango boom in Pakistan.
So that Pakistan could be exporting to India?
Well,
or not?
Let's hope so, because, of course, a great hope for that part of the world and for international stability, but also for the Pakistani economy, is that, yes, I mean, if India's markets open up to Pakistan, that could be the salvation of much of the Pakistani economy. Certainly, international, including Chinese, would-be investors in Pakistan don't think that there's any prospect of a real Pakistani boom without opening the Indian market.
Do you think, I don't want to, you know, you've talked about social unrest or sort of mentioned something like that earlier on in our conversation, but do you feel that there is some sort of food crisis approaching Pakistan? Now, I'm not just talking about the mango, but there is talk about a global food crisis heading that way. Do you see it there? Do you feel it?
I mean, not a catastrophic one as yet. You know, Pakistan does produce a great deal of food, enough certainly to ward off starvation. So it's not a, you know, this isn't a catastrophic situation like in, you know, the Horn of Africa or whatever. But there are two things. I mean, one is, yes, I mean, inflation of food prices is worsening social discontent. But much more seriously, in the long term, is the threat of really acute water shortages. They've already started in some areas, despite the floods. And the predictions of the World Bank and other organizations is that unless Pakistan can greatly improve the efficiency of its water use, then in the decades to come, they could get much worse. Well, now, at that point, some way down the line, you really could be talking about a Somali-style situation. But they're not there yet and won't be for decades. But unless they do something about it, they will be sooner or later.
Okay, well, look, thank you very much for giving us this insight. Thank you, Anatole Levin, for joining us. Bye-bye. Well, the inaugural New Cities Foundation Summit is underway in Paris, a global gathering of people who run, manage, and design our cities. Over 50 countries are represented, and who better to represent Monocle than our very own editor, Andrew Tuck, who is, of course, a city lover himself. Hi, Andrew.
Hello there.
Well, what's hot over there?
What's hot? Well, the city's quite hot, actually. It's been an amazing kind of sunny day.
Oh,
amazing. Well, kind of, because I've been indoors in the convention centre out at La Défense. But it's been a really fascinating day. There's, as you said, there's 700 delegates here, and they're trying to create a kind of Davos for urbanism. And the roll call of people who have pitched up is amazing. It's some of the world's biggest mayors. It's backed by the mayor of Paris. It's organized, actually, by the people who organized Davos as well. And there's been some really high-level kind of debates going on today about what the future of cities are. And there seems to be a real consensus around the fact that cities are growing so fast that actually lots of these mayors need to take very rapid action.
Can you just like pull out a little headline for us? Does anybody have a great idea that's exciting everybody there today?
Well, lots of things. You know, we had breakfast with Kasim Reed, who is the mayor of Atlanta. And he was talking about how his city is kind of partly betting its future on aviation in a way. And I know we're going to come to him maybe again in a little while, but he was talking about the fact that Atlanta now has the busiest airport in the world, but it's still slightly behind New York on international connections. But it's determined to take that title away from JFK in the next couple of years. And those millions of people coming through Atlanta, they want things. They want culture. They want to see a city that has much better transport. So it was interesting to see that he travels quite a lot. He's in Paris because he wants to look at examples of how French cities connect their airports, their cities. He admits that Atlanta's behind. So that was amazing. We met with the Ford Foundation as well, and they're doing a lot of work about how you kind of revitalize cities with transport. And quite controversially, George McCarthy from the Ford Foundation was saying that he believes that the projects they're backing in Detroit can turn that city around, and that we will see in the future years Detroit start growing again, really kind of because good transport is suddenly put into poorer neighborhoods.
Oh, that's really exciting.
Well, it is exciting, and it's exciting to see that so many people are willing to travel to see kind of best practice. You know, that there's the mayor of Dakar here. This afternoon we quickly had a drink with the writer Douglas Copeland and Gregor Robertson, who's the mayor of Vancouver. They're all here kind of looking to exchange ideas. And again, the Douglas Copeland, you know, he's an author, you know, obviously, but you're involved with Vancouver in trying to make that city one of the most sustainable and connected cities in the world. So they have a new system that goes into place next year where they will build thousands of these little pillars all around the city. And every pillar acts as a place to recharge your car. It's a phone mast. It's a place for you to get your internet connectedness. And so a really kind of, you know, kind of brave new world being envisaged by these mayors.
Really exciting and interesting. And I wanted to come back. You mentioned the mayor of Atlanta. Andrew, we're not going to have time to play the tape, but it's interesting. He's got civil rights on his mind. Barack Obama has got people thinking and talking about gay marriage. What did he tell you?
Well, it was just interesting to me, you know, a big American politician, a few days after, obviously, Obama has come out in support of gay marriage, because we were intrigued to know whether that kind of changes the game for every politician in America. And he admits it does. You know, he's a very religious man, but he's backed civil unions for gay couples. He has been a big supporter of the rights of gay people to adopt children. But until now, he's been opposed to gay marriage. But we asked him about that, and he said that, in fact, every politician is going to have to kind of, as it were, come out and say what they believe in. And he's obviously kind of wrestling with it. And I got the feeling that he's a big supporter of gay rights and that he may come down on the side of potentially backing gay marriage. But it was just interesting that he said that the landscape has been changed by Obama. You cannot now be a politician who sits on the fence. You have to kind of give your opinion because the president has.
It's going to be just great to see how that keeps unfolding, isn't it? Mm.
Yeah, amazing. And he is a big civil rights leader. You know, he comes from a city where some 54% of people are African American, and he's determined to be, you know, proud of that city's heritage of civil rights. It's the home of Martin Luther King, and he really wants to kind of make sure that he doesn't kind of fall out of step with kind of social change, I think.
Andrew, thanks so much for this. It's really good to hear you.
Lovely to speak to you. And I think we might try and sneak onto a show again tomorrow with more news here from the city side.
I will make you very welcome. Bye-bye for now. Andrew Tuck in Paris. That's it for today's Midori House. My thanks to producer Daniel Giacopelli, researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager Alex Jakes. At 2200 London time, that's in 3 hours, Ted Kravitz and Emma Nelson will be here with the Monocle Daily. I'm Nancy Durham, thanking you very much for listening. Goodbye.